This sale season, Ritual is urging you to think about what's essential. Your daily health? Pretty essential. Making sure your products are heavy metal tested, clean label project certified, and sourced through a traceable supply chain? Also essential. So this Black Friday, skip the micro trends and put your savings where they matter. Your health. With 40% off daily essentials like stress relief and Symbiotic Plus for gut support. Head to ritual.com/podcast and shop responsibly.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is screenwriter Peter Strawn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Nice to be here.
Now, we're going to talk about your new movie, Conclave, that you've written, and we are going to do three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. So, without further ado, let us delve into the feature film Conclave. An adaptation of a Robert Harris novel. And for this kind of project, I've always been fascinated to know, at what stage are you, the screenwriter, brought in? Has somebody decided what the story is in Conclave novel by Robert Harris? Or are you given the book to say, hey, tell us what the story is?
No, I was given the book. I don't know if it was actually out or if I was given the book before it had come out. I was given it by British producer Tessa Ross. And Robin Slovo, both producers that I've worked with before.
Yeah.
Tessa Ross on a film called Frank, and Robin Slovo on a film called Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So I was sent the book. I knew it was about a papal election. And I started reading it. I read it quickly. I think it's, you know, I was really gripped by it very quickly. Sort of somewhat unexpectedly, I guess. I don't quite know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting it to be as gripping as it was.
Yeah.
I've written about a day. And it worked as a thriller. It really worked as a thriller. It was really entertaining. It was a world, you know, that we don't know. It's set in the Vatican during a conclave, which, you know, if people don't know, is the election for a new pope. So the book begins, you know, I don't think this is a spoiler, the story begins, the death of the previous pope, and it's the cardinals gathering to elect the new one. And I loved it, and it was, I mean, I think Robert, I think he's a really good writer, very elegant, very smart, very entertaining as well. And he's very interested in politics. I think usually one way or the other, his books are really sort of concerned with politics. And this was, somebody gave me a quote from an Emily Dickinson poem the other day. I think it's the title of the poem, which is, tell it at slant, something like that anyway. And I sort of thought, yeah, that's what Conclave does. It's not just about secular. It's not really about secular politics, but it is about politics. But it talks about politics from an angle that makes everything seem fresh and new, you know?
Okay.
So, I think when we were making the film, we were thinking of those great American 70s political thrillers like All the President's Men, you know? And I think that's kind of, you kind of made those tropes feel fresh again, because it's a world we don't normally get into, that we don't see, and with characters that are, you feel different from secular political thriller characters.
So you've worked with the producers before, and you've read the book now, and you're obviously thinking about how this might look as a movie compared to a book.
Yeah.
So do you how much of what happens next is a discussion about what the film can be with the producers, and how much is it with given they've worked with you before? It's like, right, Peter, go ahead and tell us when you've got 120 pages.
I think we probably would have had maybe just one initial meeting, just to chat about it and sort of mark the beginning of the project, really. Mm. But largely, it's okay. And I felt absolutely fine with going away and just starting on it. Adaptation is different every time, depending on the book. It's a completely different job every time, depending on the book.
Okay.
Some of them, it's about dismantling the novel altogether and putting it back in a completely different way. Some of them, as you know yourself, is about kind of trying to embody the gist of the novel, but you have to kind of reimagine and you have to add a lot of new material yourself.
Yeah.
But with Conclave, I sort of pretty much stuck with the structure. And that was easy to do and made sense to do because there's a kind of countdown in Conclave. It's an election that's taking place and it takes place over a number of days and a number of elections. They have to get a majority. So, there's sort of multiple elections during the course of the film. So there's kind of a clock on it. They are sequestered, so they're locked into the Vatican. So there's this, in a funny sort of way, almost... It's not like a murder mystery, but that kind of sense of being all the characters are locked in the spooky house overnight because the road's flooded or whatever and they can't get out. It had that kind of neatness to it that we're in a sort of enclosed world that nobody can get out of. And information can't get in either, and that's sort of part of the point of it. So a lot of the sort of structure was given just by the setup,
But in that kind of sense, so in a novel, obviously you get the benefit of reaching inside somebody's head. So a character in a novel can go, "Oh, the sneaky devil. I don't believe a word he just said to me." Whereas obviously it would be odd if a character said that in a film straight after somebody saying something that was patently a lie. So what were some of the challenges there in terms of turning this secret conspiratorial kind of setting into something we could watch and hear?
So there were lots of challenges, yeah. Because also the novel has a third-person narrator, which was kind of great in the novel because it was all being narrated after the events, as it were.
Okay.
And it was a great way of giving you a sense that, well, something really unusual happened this time, you've been told this story. A sense of like, I'm going to narrate these amazing world-changing events,
Yeah.
So, and obviously we didn't do that. I mean, you could, of course. I could have used the narrator's voice, but I decided not to, and I think that was probably right. So... This is a challenge that the screenwriter always faces, really, which is how to make the implicit explicit, how to make the internal external. All you've got to work with there is dialogue, silence, visuals to some extent, as much as the screenwriter can control the visuals, you do to some extent, and action that you're describing, and obviously the thing that really makes a difference is getting great actors, because great actors can work miracles, and you can imply in the script what it is you need from them, and they can deliver that. But that is the fundamental job. How to say, in a dialogue between two characters where they're sort of, swapping pleasantries with each other, how do you make it clear to the audience that they hate each other or that they're in love with each other that's the job. Exactly the job. And that's about choosing the dialogue. And rhythm and tempo and little descriptions of action. But, generally screenwriters don't lean too much into telling the actor exactly what they should be doing with their face. So I do tend to put sort of directions, stage directions, if you like, in, but more as a rhythmic device. So if a character says one line and then that internally, there's a change in direction in terms of the next line, I kind of want to mark that in the script in some way, rather than just putting them on as if it was one of the big differences between reading a proper film script and reading a transcript of a film.
Yeah.
Is that the sort of the film script is marking the internal journey of the character, what's going on inside them. So you can just put a pause in the script, you can put beat is usually the term that's used, but sometimes you'll give a little stage direction, like, he lights a cigarette, or he smokes and blows out the smoke thoughtfully, or he stares out the window, or she, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily that you're saying the actor has to do that particular action, but you're kind of marking it as there's something happens here internally. There's a change of direction, you know. So there's all that stuff. There's working with dialogue. And I mean, the visuals, you know, you should be thinking visuals and structure as well. You know, the order that you put in the scenes in and the rhythm of the scenes. So, you know, short scenes followed by, you don't want like long 3-4 page dialogue scene followed by long 3-4 page dialogue scene. You're trying to build a rhythm like music, really, that sort of rises and falls.
Yeah, there is an argument, isn't it, that a screenplay looks like a screen, but somebody can pick a screen that doesn't look, it doesn't look good on the page, even before you've read a word. So when you see a screenplay that's sort of a lot of just dialogue, you kind of already feel like that doesn't look like a screenplay because it doesn't have the implied rhythm to it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's no rules, obviously, and some are much more wordy than others. But yeah, generally, I mean, the difference between the stage play and the screenplay is you'd expect shorter scenes, less dialogue, you know. And it was really interesting working in, you know, this is a sort of political thriller, or it is a political thriller, political drama. And it was interesting working in a sort of thriller format, because you realize it's actually very close to working in comedy in a way, in that it's nearly all about rhythm, you know.
Okay.
It's all about time. You know, it's like the timing of the gags and the timing of the tension. It's the same. It's almost the same mechanism that's at work. So somebody said, "What's the secret?" Where did I read this recently? Somebody said about comedy, and they said, "Is there a secret of comedy?" Oh, it's in Man on the Moon. You know, the film about Andy Kaufman. And Kaufman asks his guru, "Is there a secret to making people laugh?" And the guru says, "Yes, silence." And I thought, that's really true. And it's really true with thriller as well. You know, how do you build the tension? It's like the pauses, it's the silence.
Yeah.
Or it's having something that's fast and building pace, and then the pause and the silence. You know, it's rhythm always. It's rhythm that does those things to the audience.
And I suppose, given the secrecy and stuff about the setup and the world, you can always lean into the very basic thing of drama, which is somebody is searching for the truth, or at least trying to find out what that person really is. You know, everybody isn't what they're supposed to be. I mean, you said it yourself at the beginning. You could almost put Poirot in the room, couldn't you? And be like, just looking
absolutely,
around.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And in Conclave, nobody is what they seem, you know. And even the main character, even Rafe's character, Lawrence, I think, probably doesn't understand really everything about himself, you know, and that's part of the journey of the film. And also there were things that helped with, you know, just nuts and bolts exposition, that there are... priests and I'm trying to think of the term. He's not a canon. I can't remember the rank he is in the church. But there are a few characters who are trying to help Lawrence, and he gives them tasks to do, and that allows you to discuss some of his doubts or some of the things they're worrying about. So it was a way of getting exposition believably into the film. You know, which again is something you're always looking for, isn't it? How can I get this information to the audience without it glaring, you know, and being too obvious?
Yeah, I was going to say, you're inviting us into a world we don't know. How much did you have to avoid not spending too much time making sure we understood this world? Whereas obviously the drama itself should serve as an explanation of itself, shouldn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't too tricky, to be honest. I mean, some of it, I think you just like some of the rituals and things, you just go with it, and you know the audience will go along. They don't necessarily know what the daily rituals of a conclave are, but you just show them. And they go, oh, that's what it's like. And by the way, they're really, they're quite strange, some of the details of the conclave. And they're fascinating, and they're very theatrical. The way that a conclave is held, you know, the way the votes are counted, there's a needle with red thread is put through each paper vote. And so it's like beautiful visually, you know, it's a gift visually. And of course, I should have said this, I mean, the most, you know, what's the very heart of drama? Conflict. And by its very nature, an election is ritualized conflict. You know, I mean, it's about as close as you get to actually having a physical fight. I mean, that's what elections are, aren't they?
Yeah.
Came up with to stop us just having to have physical fights.
Somebody wins, somebody loses, quite literally from the outcome.
Exactly, and you know who the different, you know, combatants are on it. So it really lent itself to drama as a sort of core subject. Yeah. But in terms of the complexity of the world, again, because conclaves don't happen that often, obviously. It's, you know, because a pope is elected for life, so it's only when a pope dies, there's another one. So there were opportunities for Lawrence, who's running the conclave, to explain to the other cardinals certain aspects of what they were going to have to do, okay, because some cardinals have never been a conclave before either, you know. So, yeah, that made it easier.
How far into the drafting process does, in this instance, Edward Berger, the director, come into play? And then what is your relationship to Edward in terms of developing it to be the shooting script?
So I can't remember exactly. I think I probably was under the second or third draft.
Okay.
When Edward came on board. And then we continued to work on it closely with Edward. Lots of visual ideas. There were some plot things that we kind of finessed and polished, and some ideas we tried out and decided against. So yeah, really closely. Edward's, I mean, that relationship, again, like the relationship with the book, changes every time.
Mm.
Edward was fantastically collaborative. Apart from being a great director to work with.
Yeah.
And I did something which I've never done before, which I sort of asked Edward if I could be on set for a little bit. I don't normally do it. Normally, because there's not normally much for the writer to do on set. You know, you're kind of a tourist, unless things have gone wrong and you're trying to rewrite on the day, you know, which isn't usually a great sign. But I did sort of, I think I was going to be in Rome for another reason anyway. And I said, can I come on set? And he said, absolutely. So I was only going to go for a week or so. And I think he kind of liked having me there. And he said, how would you feel about staying? So I ended up staying for a lot of it, like 2/3 of the shoot, which I've never done before.
Right.
And I loved it. And that's down to Edward making, you know, you feel, because not every director wants the writer hanging around, you know.
Yeah.
But he made me feel really welcome and really part of the team. And it was lovely because, you know, well, you know what it's like yourself. There are stages that a production goes through. And as the writer, you're usually at the beginning.
Mm.
And then there's a where it's taken away from you, you know, and usually then the primary relationship is between the director and the actors, or perhaps the director and the cinematographer. And then there's a further stage where it's between the director and the editor, you know. Mm. So there's a point where you no longer really feel deeply connected to the project. Sometimes you might come back in the edit, actually, you know, sometimes a writer can be useful in the edit. But in this case, I felt like part of the team all the way through. And that was a lovely feeling, you know. It was kind of like running away with the circus, being part of this big crew, shooting it. And it also, it was sort of useful, I think, you know. We did make some adjustments, having said that the writer doesn't normally do much on set. Because I was there anyway, you know, and we would talk with the actors and we'd block out scenes and we'd make some adjustments, little nips and tucks here and there, change some lines. You know, sometimes actors have great ideas and you think, that's fantastic, let's try that out. And so it was just this little added layer of polishing, I guess, you know, that we're doing during the shoot, which was A, very enjoyable, and B, I think, useful.
I think one of the great mysteries for any writers listening in is about sort of output when you're writing. So what people's daily routines are like, you know, when you're on your own and you've got nobody else to copy, you're just doing your own thing. But then you hear other people do it. One of my favourites that broke through for me was I heard Michael Arndt talk about the fact that his daily routine involved drinking coffee, reading the paper, then procrastinating until he hated himself. And it was quite gratifying to hear that every day wasn't winning a cup, you know, when you're writing, you know. Yeah. It's like, so just, I'm not asking you for your sort of darkest moments, but more like when a job's going well, what daily targets, what routine do you even put in place for yourself? Are you an early bird?
It's morphed a lot over the years. It's definitely changed a lot. Now it's pretty much settled into what I think would be the pattern for, you know, until I retire, which is I work in the morning now. Most of the writing gets done in the morning.
Okay.
I've started starting earlier than I ever used to. You know, I hated getting up early and I hated starting work early. Now I kind of do get up early and I start work like, I don't know, maybe 8 at the latest, sometimes a bit earlier.
Right.
And I kind of, it depends, again, what the project is, what stage you're at with it, etc. 4 hours, I think, is productive writing. That's probably, that's where the good stuff would happen and it goes off the boil if I'm working for longer than that.
Mm.
But again, it depends. If you're doing the second draft or if you're polishing, then I think you can still do useful, like, editing work in the afternoon or even in the evening. But definitely the morning is where the bulk of the productive stuff happens for me. again, if it's an adaptation from a book, and if it's a fairly straightforward adaptation, I can do more than that. I can do, you know, much more than that. But if it's original and you're facing that blank white page and thinking, I don't know what happens next, yeah. then I can't do that all day and it'd be good stuff. It just starts to go off the boil really quickly, you know.
Do you set yourself daily targets for writing, or do you have a daily target that you...
I don't. I mean, we were just talking about this earlier on, weren't we? I probably have set myself targets at times, and then I just failed so often that I probably stopped doing that. On average, I think, this depends completely on the project, etc. As an average, I would say maybe 4 pages.
Yeah.
Which isn't very much. I mean, but some days you're on a roll and you hit 10 pages. Mm. Other days you do your 4 and then you go back and think, well, they're all crap, and you...
Save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up with your card. Then get a juicy frozen grade A Kroger turkey for 49 cents a pound, limit one with a $25 additional purchase with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Weight loss. It needs to be fast and sustainable. Noom GLP-1 starts at just $149 and ships to your door in 7 days. Take it from Clavossier, who lost 35 pounds on Noom.
It's a psychological thing, too. They're definitely teaching how to live a better, healthier lifestyle. Noom is teaching me the habits so I do not have to be on weight loss meds forever.
Don't believe it? Take it from Lauren, who lost 22 pounds on Noom.
If I come off of the GLP-1, it's not going to automatically make my weight yo-yo back. I'm going to have good skills and know what to do to take care of myself.
$149 GLP-1s? Now that's Noom smart. Noom, the smart way to lose weight. Get started with Noom GLP-1 at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. Individual results may vary. Not all customers will medically qualify for prescription medications. Compounded medications are not reviewed by the FDA for safety, efficacy, or quality.
It ends up getting cut down to 1. So it's, yeah, it depends very much on the day.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, thanks for sharing that. Conclave is out now, directed by All Quiet on the Western Front director Edward Berger, and starring Ralph Fiennes, Stanley Tucci, John Lithgow, and Isabella Rossellini, among many others. And we will now move on to 3 films that have impacted everything in your adult life. You've given me 3 movies. I'll do them in the order that you've given me. For those that haven't heard this format before, Peter gets 5 minutes maximum to talk about these movies, why they're important, why they hold fond memories. And every time 5 minutes are up, we will hear this sound, which you can hear at your end, okay, Peter?
I can't hear that at my end.
Good man. Right then. Our first film is an adaptation of Don Pierce's novel, Cool Hand Luke, from 1967, starring Paul Newman in the titular iconic role. But tell us, why is this such an impactful movie in your life?
So, in a way, I think I'm going to say the same thing about all 3 films, which is, you know, like most of us, I was... especially probably back then, because I'm in my 50s, I was brought up on film, but I was brought up on a certain kind of film. I was brought up on a lot of Hollywood films. So there was a lot of black and white films on when I was a kid. There were a lot of Westerns, a lot of war films. So it was a certain kind of mainstream entertainment cinema, which was great and which I still, you know, love. And some of my favorite films are, you know, Casablanca, all the usuals, everyone will say Casablanca and Some Like It Hot, all of those things are, they'd be my go-tos, but to, you know, feel good movies. But I remember that, I remember the first time seeing a film that didn't sort of fit into that mold, and probably Cool Hand Luke was what, there was a crop of films I saw which were all American 70s movies, must have been on television when I was probably in my early teens, maybe. And it was a different kind of film, suddenly. It was a different kind of storytelling with a different kind of atmosphere. Things were more complex and they weren't as simple and black and white. And I remember being disorientated, but in a good way by them. You know, you were used to thinking, this is what a film is. This is what happens to the hero. And then these 70s American films came along. And there was a crop of... I mean, Cool Hand Luke is just a film I love, but probably around about the same time I would have seen One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm.
I remember seeing Dog Day Afternoon around about that time as well, you know. So there were all of these films that were just completely different from the Hollywood and the British films, indeed, that, you know, I'd been brought up on. And I think they probably also all, well, they were all had a kind of anti-authoritarian thing in them, which I kind of really liked and responded to, even though I'm a complete coward myself. I like watching these rebels stand up against the man.
Vicarious, it is, they call it.
Vicarious, exactly, yeah. Which, of course, is in a way what Cool Hand Luke is about, because Cool Hand Luke is someone who's a natural rebel. But who the, I mean, if you don't know the story of Cool Hand Luke, it's Paul Newman gets arrested for unscrewing the tops of parking meters. It's like the stupid crime he does when he's drunk. Goes into this terrible prison in the southern states. And kind of won't toe the line. It's an awful prison, you know, run by sadists, and he just won't toe the line. He just naturally has to fight back. And he becomes a kind of symbol of resistance for the other men in there as well, who start to gather around him. He's got a kind of natural leadership. And what's really brilliant about the film is, in the end, he doesn't want to do it anymore, but they kind of force him into that role. So it's almost, the film plays a bit with a kind of Christ image, you know, that he's sacrificed on their behalf to give them hope. There's a bit where he escapes and he sends them postcards, and because he's got out, they all, you know, they all find the will to fight. But in the end, the forces that be, spoiler, the forces that be drag him back, and he's killed at the very end. And there is this sort of sense that he's sacrificed for the other men, you know. Paul Newman's fantastic in it. I mean, it's a great cast, but George Kennedy, I think, plays Dragline. He's the sort of bruiser bully when Paul Newman goes in, who ends up being won over by Paul Newman. I noticed this. So there's this kind of symbol of the authorities and of the man. And it's one of the officers who wears shades, mirrored shades the whole time, and has a bunch of keys. And he's the guy who shoots Paul Newman, Cool Hand Luke, at the end. And I suddenly noticed in Spielberg that Spielberg uses that a lot. I think he does it in Close Encounters, and he definitely does it in E.T. That the faceless forces of authority have these mirrored shades. And I think in E.T. there's a bunch of keys that he focuses on a lot when they're coming in and out. So I thought that was just a nice.
He never took them glasses off, you know, when they weren't shooting.
Is that right?
Yeah, to keep the intimidation of the character going during the shoot.
It's such a simple little detail, and it's brilliant. It's just that you can't see his eyes, and he doesn't show any emotion, you know, and he stops being human. It's so good. So I loved it. And again, it was this sort of tone that was hard to, you know, when you're used to, oh, it's a comedy, or oh, it's a love story, or oh, it's a war film. What's Cool Hand Luke? You know, there's parts of it are really funny. There's parts of it that are uplifting. And then it's got this tragic ending. Oh, there we go. I love it. If you haven't seen it, watch it. Also great soundtrack.
Anti-hero, which I suppose is what he is, because he's sticking it to authority. He's not, that's his antagonist.
I think that's what I meant by it being sort of disorientating, in that you can, you know, by the old rules, by the 50s film rules or the 40s film rules, generally, probably Cagney bends some of these.
Yeah.
He should, you know, he's an arrested felon. But within the context of the film, you realize, you know, he's the moral one. It's the authorities that are immoral. So I would argue he's not an anti-hero, except he doesn't want to be a hero at all by the end.
Yes, indeed. That's the drama, survive, isn't it? That's the drama. Yeah. That he's made to be a hero when he just wants
to be a hero.
He wants to slip out and just forget this ever happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right then. Number two is Martin Scorsese's favorite Stanley Kubrick movie, 1975's Barry Lyndon, which, before you start, can I just say, I was reading today, because I've lived the lie that there was no electric lights used on this set. That's a bit of a myth, apparently. There was some electric light used, but candlelight was...
But there are scenes that are just candlelight, aren't they? Because I believe they
use super candles. They developed a super lens with NASA.
Yeah.
But also they used three wick candles to make sure they got light, because single wick candles burnt too quickly.
That's still just using candles.
No, it is. No, the internal stuff is, but yeah, it's... There was some use. That was kind of a myth that I busted for myself while getting ready for today. But tell me, why does Barry Lyndon have such an impact on you?
So Kubrick's had a big impact on me. And I would have seen Barry Lyndon again around about this time in my teens. And again, it was part of this process of thinking, oh, film can do that. Film can tell the story that way, you know. Mm. I really like Kubrick because it's sort of, I admire the fact that it, in some ways it's art house cinema and in some ways it's mainstream cinema. And it's
absolutely.
And there are some directors who can pull that off, and I always find it really admirable, and it's just great. And Kubrick's one of them. Weird little fact about Barry Lyndon, one of my favorite films, I forget the title all the time. So when someone says, what's your favorite film? I always go, oh, it's, and then I can never remember Barry Lyndon. Because I don't know why, I've got some blank spot, but it is one of my favorite films. Why do I like it? I mean, it's incredibly beautiful.
Mm.
There are the candlelit scenes, but it's just generally incredibly beautiful. It's a lot of fixed frame shots, which I don't think I've seen done before, you know, so the camera's very static. The performances are brilliant, kind of sort of blank, and it does this strange thing, which I don't think I've seen, again, hadn't seen done until then, which is it kind of starts as a comedy and very, very slowly darkens into a tragedy.
Does it ever.
And beautifully done. It's got a freeze frame at the end, which is probably, again, one of the first freeze frames I've seen, it's just a marvelous little idea. It's Barry Lyndon, who's lost his leg by the end, hopping into the carriage. And in my memory, anyway, it freeze frames on him sort of doing that halfway into the carriage. I don't know why, but that really stuck with me. Fantastic use of music, as always, by Kubrick. One of the things I love about him is how clever he is with music. He uses two pieces, a saraband by, I think, Handel, and then there's a Schubert trio, and they both recur at various points in the film, and it's like this slow, inexorable march, you know, of fate that's about going down. And the other thing it does, which I don't think I'd seen before, and I love, I directed a little short film and tried it myself. You don't see it very often, and that was to have a narrator. Not a voiceover, not a character voiceover, but a narrator.
Yeah.
And I think it's Michael Horden narrates Barry Lyndon. And there's something about that, the distancing effect of that, you know, it's almost like God telling you the story. Or all tone is very cool and removed. It's not, you know, it doesn't wallow in the emotion at all. But in a way, I found that more moving because of that, because it's you're just shown the terrible things that happened to Barry and to others sort of dispassionately, you know, and it's sort of, the whole thing feels shot through with a kind of sorrow to me, you know,
I've not read the memoir of Barry Lyndon, the William Thackeray book that it's adapted from, but do you think then that was a decision in the adaptation, what you were saying earlier about Concave being written from the third person, so clearly it's building to an event, then to use that trick in a film is actually quite a bold move, isn't it, in a way?
It is, because, of course, in lots of ways, it's a sort of ramshackle. I mean, it becomes an extraordinary life, I suppose, when he marries.
Mm.
But in some ways, it's a ramshackle adventure. So if, you know, a young Irishman who ends up in the British Army and then leaves the British Army and he wanders through Europe. But the fact it's being narrated in chapters makes it feel like, well, this is a significant tale, I'm being told. You know, it's given importance and a gravitas by being narrated like that. I love it. I love it.
Obviously, Ryan O'Neill plays the titular role. Now, going back to Cool Hand Luke, Jack Lemmon was first asked to play the role that Paul Newman plays.
I think it was his production company, wasn't it?
Well, he ended up becoming producer. He didn't think he was right for the role.
And he was right, man, because I could not see Jack Lemmon playing Cool Hand Luke.
Whereas Richard Harris was touted for the role of Barry Lyndon. Now, that doesn't seem like it's a very different choice. But you don't see won't necessarily be a spoiling. I mean, it's not to take away from Ryan's performance.
It's a very logical choice, really. You know, I mean, probably.
Finish your thought.
Well, no, I'm glad it wasn't, in a way, because there's a kind of, I think he's brilliant at doing innocence and he's brilliant at doing that kind of blankness. And Barry Lyndon barely speaks, by the way, another reason why the narrator is important.
Mm.
And I think Richard Harris is too sort of vital and animalistic, and he's there. And, you know, there's a kind of something pale with Barry Lyndon, which I think is great in the performance.
I mean, I must admit, I never saw the film until the early noughties. And when Leonard Rossiter playing Captain John Quinn, it's funny, but he's playing a straight role. He's in a straight film. That's the first time I've ever seen him play. Like, and he stole every scene he's in.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite funny, though, isn't it? That's what I mean about it, because it sort of feels like it's starting like a comedy,
yeah,
and then of sorts, and then gets darker and darker. full of great performances, though. Sorry, anyway, we passed the buzzer.
Indeed. Right then, your third and final choice is set in Minnesota, a place that the writer-directors Joel and Ethan Coen described as Siberia with family restaurants. I'm talking about the wonderful neo-noir Fargo from 1996, based on a true story, I do believe.
Yeah, but it wasn't, was it? But I love the fact that they just said that.
Apparently, 3 weeks into the shoot, they revealed to the cast that it wasn't, which I love that idea.
I love that idea. Yeah, too. There is something great about just putting that card up at the beginning because it changes the way the audience are absorbing the whole story, doesn't it?
Why did this film have impact on you? Because this is more, I'm guessing this is more you're watching it as it's coming out, whereas I guess the other two you're seeing.
I think this was maybe the first Coen Brothers film I saw. I would have been in my 20s. Obviously, this is a later film, clearly. The Coen Brothers were a huge influence on me when I was starting writing films. I mean, that basically I wanted to write Coen Brothers films, yeah. You know, so the those first scripts I wrote were kind of black comedy, black violent comedies, very much in the mold of Fargo.
Right.
And again, I think, I mean, you know, I could have been Ponzi and picked a real arthouse film because that happened as well, you know, sort of seeing proper arthouse for the first time, you know, yeah. Galatar or whatever, thinking, oh, film can actually do that then. You know, it's a long way away from 50s Hollywood. But the sort of, this felt like another step again. The Coen Brothers, because I think maybe, you know, and as I said about Kubrick, there are things about them which are not mainstream at all, and yet they feel very available to you, yeah. The audience. You know? And there's sometimes some of the films, I mean, you know, there's things like Raising Arizona, where you go, okay, that's a straight out and out comedy. Mm. The Big Lebowski, one of my favorite films, straight out and out comedy. Fargo, you look at it and you go, I'm not too sure what this is, because it's very funny in parts. Mm. It's pitch black in parts as well. Yeah. You know, it's a very cynical, dark view of humanity. And I always remember there's a bit towards the end where Marge is bringing, I can't remember the name of the actor actually, but the other villain apart from Steve Buscemi, the one who survives, and she's bringing him in.
The character Peter Stormer plays.
Yes, that's the one. Whatever he's called, and she's bringing him in, and he's in the back of the car, and she says, "I just don't understand you people. I just don't understand you people. All over money, but it's the music. It's the way the music then swells. You know that the title music for Fargo. It's really epic and stirring. Mm. And again, it just has this weird effect. It's that mix of tones into this completely different tone. You know that it's neither comedy nor just tragedy or a crime drama. It becomes something." Really powerful and sort of epic, weirdly, Fargo. So it made me think, God, you can do almost anything with film. Then you can do anything, and you should strain for, you know, new tones, if that makes sense.
I mean, if I'm right, they repeat a motif, but in obviously different weather. The opening of Blood Simple is the rainy car, and This Is Texas speech goes on, and in this one you've got the car and the snow. Driven down, both of them down epic American roads, which I guess symbolizes America away from the big cities, I suppose, is maybe absolutely. Something they're and trying to say.
It's a noir trope as well, I suppose, isn't it? Starting with the car, you know, I've seen a lot of noir films that start that way. But I love them. I love the Coen Brothers.
Well, interestingly, Peter Stormer's character, apparently he had turned down a role in Miller's Crossing, and then took the role. And then took the role in Fargo, which becomes.
He would have been Dutch in Miller's Crossing, I would imagine.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And and
so he would have been a very good Dutch.
But then, weirdly, after the fact, he then formed a band called Blonde on Fargo in tribute to the fact that Fargo became his breakout movie as an actor.
He's really good in it. And it's one of my favourite lines, and it's a one-word line where he goes, unguent, and he's cut his hand when they're busy kidnapping the wife, and he goes in the bathroom to find her, unguent.
Is that a Swedish word, or is that just a made-up word?
No, you know? it just means ointment. You know, it's just
okay. There's a couple of lines that he says in Swedish, which were improvised, and they left in Fargo.
Right.
Because it was just so effective, there was no need
to
change it. And I think it's the closing scenes... There's supposed to be an empty road, and they'd ask the town to keep the road clear, And a snow clearer fella just was like, I'm ignoring that. And that stays in the shot because the municipal van just comes into shot and that's in the end of the film.
Yeah, which is funny because when you look at a Coen Brothers script and, you know, if you're interested in screenwriting, they're great scripts to look at because, you know, some, you look at them,
finish it up.
They're beautiful scripts to read. And that they're so detailed. They know, you know, they nail the shots down in the script. So you don't imagine, they're not the filmmakers that usually leave much of the chance, I guess, or improvisation is what I was going to say.
But I guess because they're writing and directing, they might as well capture the thought as they're going.
But the way they describe action, you know, like if you read a Paul Thomas Anderson script, for example, I mean, obviously, you know, incredible director.
Yeah.
But it's in his head and he doesn't really bother putting a lot of the detail on the page. I guess he's just thinking, I know exactly what I'm going to do with that. You know, he just puts it down. But the Coen brothers will write, you know, the sound that the door makes when it screeches open. You know, if you read No Country for Old Men, the description they give of the fight scenes and things like that, you know, you just, you're watching the film in your head as you read it. Great filmmaker.
Well, thank you for sharing three films that have impacted everything in your adult life and a little look behind the curtain of writing Conclave. That was really interesting. I should remind people that Conclave is out now. So go see it. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on the Britflix podcast.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
This sale season, Ritual is urging you to think about what's essential. Your daily health? Pretty essential. Making sure your products are heavy metal tested, clean label project certified, and sourced through a traceable supply chain? Also essential. So this Black Friday, skip the micro trends and put your savings where they matter. Your health. With 40% off daily essentials like Stress Relief and Symbiotic Plus for gut support. Head to ritual.com/podcast and shop responsibly.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.